So I'm going to talk about the work which we are now finalizing with Michele Frigerio and Alexei Smirnov from Trieste. And the main idea was to study what we can learn about the seesaw mechanism, about the right-handed sector, with our present knowledge of the low energy neutrino data. You remember last week at Ivan's talk, Boris Kaiser asked, can we find out what the masses of right-handed neutrinos are from our knowledge? So we anticipated your question and decided to make a little study of that. So actually, it's not only that we want to study the masses of right-handed neutrinos. We want to see what we can learn about them in general, about the structure of the whole right-handed sector, the masses, the mixing parameters, CP violation if possible. And of course, the motivation is that the seesaw mechanism seems to be by far the nicest explanation of the smallness of neutrino mass, and therefore we want to know as much as possible about the implementation of this mechanism, about the right-handed sector. And since this right-handed sector seems to operate at very high energy scales, the low energy neutrino data apparently provides us with the only possibility to test this, because it cannot be tested directly in direct experiments. Now, what do we know about low energy neutrinos? Let me just very briefly summarize what everyone knows, of course. If we ignore the LSND result, we can explain all the neutrino data with just three neutrino species, nu e, nu mu, and nu tau. Oh, thanks. And there are, in general, three possibilities for the neutrino mass ordering. There is a normal hierarchy, in which we have two light neutrinos and one heavier one, and delta m square solar is this mass square difference between one and two, and this is delta m square atmospheric, which is responsible for the atmospheric neutrino oscillations. Or we can have an inverted hierarchy in which nu one and nu two are upstairs and nu three is downstairs. And of course, neutrinos may be also quasi-degenerate, with all three neutrina having approximately the same mass and only the mass square differences being hierarchical. And the important point is that the solar mass square difference is smaller than the atmospheric one, and it is much smaller, but in fact, it is not too much smaller, and this is the important point. We also need the leptonic mixing matrix, which is sometimes called PMNS mixing matrix. And we use the standard parameterization for this mixing matrix, in which it can be written as a product of three rotation matrices in the plane 2, 3, 1, 3, and 1, 2. And this factor is responsible for the solar neutrino oscillation, this one for the atmospheric neutrino oscillation. And this is a link between them, which is in particular responsible for the short baseline atmospheric, reactor oscillations. And here, this is just similar to the quark mixing matrix. And there's an extra parameter K, which is a diagonal matrix of phases, which is there if neutrinos are Majorana particles. So in addition to one CP violating phase present here, the Dirac type phase, there are in general two more phases which are there if neutrinos are Majorana particles. And we know that two of the mixing.
Pointed only at the two right-hand matrices, similar to the quark mixing matrix.
No,
you meant the whole thing.
No, the whole thing. Yeah, sure. This whole thing is similar to the quark.
Okay. You only pointed it right, though. I thought you were making some.
Sure. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Now we know quite a bit about the mixing parameters. We know that theta 1,2 is of order 0.6. Theta 2,3 is very close to pi over 4. Theta 1,3 is less than about 0.16, but we know nothing about all CP violating phases. Now, just to summarize the data, we know that delta M square solar is around this value now, and the mixing parameter theta 1,2 is given by this expression. Delta M square 3,1 is about a few times 10 to minus 3 electron volt. And mixing angle close to the maximum one, and there is an upper limit coming from shore on theta 1-3. And if we assume some hierarchy of neutrinos, this would mean that we know the neutrino masses. So we know in the case of normal hierarchy, then the heaviest neutrino mass is approximately square root of delta m squared 3-1, and it's given here, and the second one is given here, and the smallest one we don't know, but we just know that it should be smaller than m2, or maybe much smaller than m2. In the case of the inverted hierarchy, we can do similar thing. We can find the masses of m1 and m2, roughly they're of this order of magnitude, and the splitting between them is given by this expression. And again, the lightest neutrino mass we don't know, but we know that it should be at least a factor of few smaller than the heavier one. So now we want to see what we can say about the Cisson mechanism, starting with this. In the Cisson mechanism, the simplest version, we just add three heavy Majorana right-handed neutrinos to the standard model, and the mass terms in the Lagrangian look like this. This is for charged leptons, usual mass term produced by Yukawa interaction with the Higgs. The same for Dirac type neutrino mass, and in addition, we can add a bare mass term, which is Majorana-like mass term for heavy right-handed neutrinos, and in some extensions of the standard model, it may be not just bare mass term, like in a 10 GOT, for example, it comes through, say, triplet, right-handed triplet Higgs, but it doesn't matter for us at the moment. So the mass matrix of neutrinos can be written in this basis, nu L and conjugate of N right in this way, and we obtain, after we block diagonalize it to decouple heavy and light degrees of freedom, we obtain a well-known formula for the effective mass matrix of light left-handed neutrinos. So this is the formula which we want to study. Now, in addition to explaining in a very nice way the smallness of neutrino mass, the Cisson mechanism has another very interesting and appealing feature. It has a built-in mechanism for the baryogenesis. You don't have to add any ingredients to the Cisson. They are all there. You can explain the baryon asymmetry of the universe through the leptogenesis mechanism, which was already discussed here, so I'll be very brief in reviewing it. Of course, the parameters have to be in certain range in order to explain the observed baryon asymmetry of the universe. And we, in particular, want to check whether this is consistent with the low-energy neutrino data. So in this mechanism, we have a lepton number and CP violating decay out of equilibrium decay of heavy Majorana neutrinos, which produce the net lepton number. And this lepton number is then reprocessed by sphalerons, which conserve B minus L but violate B plus L into the baryon asymmetry. And here the important points are the Sakharov's, famous Sakharov's conditions of C, CP violation, baryon number violation, and out of equilibrium. So how can they, how are they realized in this scenario? CP violation comes through the fact that the Yukawa couplings of right-handed neutrinos are complex, and there is an interference between the three-level and one-loop diagrams, which is important. At three-level, you don't have any CP violation. And C violation is just the mere consequence of the fact that Yukawa couplings are chiral, and therefore they break C by 100%. B violation comes through the combination of the lepton number violation in due to the Majorana masses of right-handed neutrinos and B plus L violation by sphalerons. And the out of equilibrium condition is satisfied if the decay rate of the lightest of these heavy neutrinos is smaller than the Hubble parameter at the time of their decay, at the temperature of their decay. So this condition here can be, the out of equilibrium condition can be written in terms of some effective parameter m twiddle, and the condition that m twiddle given here, and this yd is just the Dirac type Yukawa couplings of neutrinos, so it should be less than some universal parameter m star, which is about 1.1 10 to minus 3 electron volt. So here, this is the interesting point, so maybe I should say a few more words about that. And the final number which we want to explain is the variant of photon number in the universe, which is with the latest WMAP data included, is given by this number. Now, coming back to this m star, it's an interesting point that it is in a very interesting range of values. So a little bit more in detail about this out of equilibrium condition. The decay rate of a heavy Majorana neutrino is given by this expression. And we want this to be smaller than the Hubble parameter at the temperature at equal to the mass of this decaying particle. Now, the Hubble parameter is given by this expression. This is the number of light particle species in equilibrium. And if we introduce the parameter m twiddle, which is just given by this expression, we can directly relate it to the decay rate of this particle. At the same time, if you look at it, it resembles very much the usual CISO formula for the neutrino mass. And therefore, we expect it to be somehow related to the masses of light neutrinos. It's not surprising that, in fact, it is related. But not directly. It's some kind of more complicated relation. So it's an effective mass. It's not the usual mass of one of these light neutrinos. But in some particular cases, there are some very simple expressions for that, as we shall see. Now, the condition that the decay rate is less than the Hubble parameter can be directly written in this way, as I said. And this m star is some combination of universal constants times the square root of this number of light degrees of freedom times electron wave square divided by m Planck. So it's kind of universal constant. And it turns out to be almost exactly equal to 10 to minus 3 electron volt, which is a very interesting range of values from the point of view of the low energy neutrino phenomenology. It's pure coincidence, but it's very indicative one. So it may be there is something deep behind this.
If these decays were happening with the universe was supersymmetric, then...
Yeah, it's, it turns out that you double the number of degrees of freedom, and essentially you also double the contribution of the epsilon, so-called epsilon 1, the asymmetry produced in the decay of the lightest of this heavy Majorana neutrinos. So in the end, the result is almost unchanged. You divide one by the other, and the result is almost unchanged. So in the MSSM, for example, the result is nearly the same as in the case of the minimal standard model. Also, the fraction of B minus L, which is reprocessed into the baryon number, in one case is 28 over 79, which is approximately one-third. In another case is 21 over 8, which is also approximately one-third. So it's very... minus 1, yes. 8 over 21, yeah. So numerically, the results are very similar. Now, this epsilon 1 is just the ratio of the difference of the rates of lightest heavy neutrino decay into leptons and the Higgses and the CP conjugate channel divided by their sum. And it's given from this interference of three-level and one-loop diagrams is given by this expression. And there's an imaginary part of the product y dagger y between 1 and I, and there's sum over I where I doesn't include 1. And there is a function depending on the ratio of the masses, they should be squared here, and this function is given here. The interesting term is here. This term becomes very important when there is some degeneracy between the heavy neutrino masses. So this is because in the loop contribution to the wave function normalization of a heavy neutrino, the intermediate state is almost on shell in this case. So we have some kind of enhancement. In addition, when we want to calculate the final result, the variant to photon number, there is some epsilon 1, some numerical factor of order 10 to minus 2, and there is a dilution factor because of the washout effects. And this dilution factor has to be calculated using just solving a set of coupled Boltzmann equations. But for certain situations, there are some analytic formulas which approximate these solutions of the Boltzmann equation. And in the interesting for us range of parameter k, where k is the ratio of m twiddle, m1 twiddle to m star, it is just given by this formula. One can find it in the book of Kolb and Turner.
Questions?
Yeah?
First of all, when you talk about the decay of m to a Higgs and a lepton,
yeah,
do you mean a charged lepton?
Everything. Both charged
and neutrino.
So it's decay into a doublet.
Yes.
SSO.
And outside it also.
Sorry?
No, no. And also he answered the question I was asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that also includes the anti-electron.
Sure. Yeah, of course, yeah.
So the neutral lepton asymmetry is the same as the charged lepton asymmetry.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
another question?
Yeah.
This constraint that you found by insisting that an out of equilibrium, basically.
Yes.
That is independent of the mass of the heavy, or it's not independent? You found the constraint on this thing you call M1 twiddle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is inversely proportional to the mass of the heavy.
Does it result in a bound on the heavy?
Yes, exactly. And this the bound, it's very important, actually. So this figure you have already seen in the talk of Ivan. This is from the paper of Buchmüller and collaborators. So they calculated the maximum asymmetry, the allowed range for maximum asymmetry as a function of two parameters, M1 twiddle and M1. So M1 twiddle in general also depends in principle of M1. So it's not completely independent. On the other hand, there are no one-to-one correspondence between them. There's something more on that. And therefore, it can be considered as an independent parameter. So if you study this, you find that there is some absolute minimum below which you cannot produce a significant, a sufficient amount of the Baryon asymmetry at all. And this is around a few times 10 to the 9 GeV. Actually, it should be slightly higher now. This was not including the latest WMAP data. Now, if you include them, all this figure goes a little bit up. And that's the important point. If the heaviest of these right-handed Majorana neutrinos is too light, you don't produce enough baryon asymmetry. However, this figure was obtained assuming that the right-handed Majorana neutrinos are hierarchical in mass. It does not apply to the cases when they are degenerate or quasi-degenerate.
And what happens then, or it's not
known? You can decrease it significantly, lower it significantly. Now, after this a little bit lengthy introduction, let me go to the main topic. So what we can learn about the right-handed sector from the low energy neutrino data. So what we want to do is just to take our present knowledge about light neutrinos and try to find out what we can say about right-handed Majorana neutrinos. First of all, I mean, we use this formula. So first of all, we need a left-hand side. The left-hand side is this, our input, low energy neutrino data. So in order to get it, this is the matrix, we need to rotate the diagonal matrix of the mass eigenvalues of light neutrinos with the leptonic mixing matrix. So we need both this part and this part. And of course, this cannot be done in a model-independent way. We have to assume some hierarchy. For example, if we assume the normal hierarchy, we know this and this from the solar and atmospheric neutrino data, and we only know that M1 is smaller than M2 and probably much smaller, but we don't know how much smaller. So we have to vary M1 between 0 and, say, factor 3 smaller than M2. Here, we can reconstruct this matrix from the known mixing parameters. Of course, we don't know theta 1,3, we only know the upper limit, so we have to vary theta 1,3 between 0 and its upper limit. On top of that, we don't know the CP violating phases, so we have to assume that they can be whatever one wishes. We don't have any constraint on them, so we don't want to constrain them. We allow them to be arbitrary. Okay, next, we need to assume something about the Dirac sector. We don't actually know the Dirac mathematics which enters into this CISO formula, so we have to assume something to get some result. One cannot get any result in a model independently. So we need some assumptions which we think are reasonable. And these assumptions are the following. First, we assume that the Dirac type mathematics of neutrinos is hierarchical. So the eigenvalues are very hierarchical and similar to the eigenvalues of the up-type or down-type quark matrices or charged electron mathematics. And the motivation for this is that all other known Dirac-type mathematics are hierarchical. And in GATs, for example, in SO10 GAT, we can directly relate, for example, Dirac-type mathematics of neutrinos with the corresponding mathematics of up-type quarks, for example. So this is a very reasonable assumption. Next, we need to assume something about the mixing in the Dirac mathematics. And this is much less obvious. In general, the Dirac mathematics can be written as a diagonal matrix rotated on the left and on the right by two different unitary matrices. Now, we are especially concerned about this matrix, which we do not know, and we do not know how to get any information about that. There is no experimental way, except in supersymmetric models, to get any handle on this unitary matrix. So what's the meaning of this matrix? We work in the basis where the charged lepton matrix has been diagonalized. So this matrix is essentially a mismatch between left-handed rotations which diagonalize the charged lepton matrix and the neutrino Dirac type matrix. If we use the analogy with the quark sector, we should expect this matrix to be small. The rotation to be small, the matrix to be close to unity, to one. And this is our assumption, actually. So the assumption is that this is very close to the unit matrix, and the large mixing which appears in the leptonic sector at low energies comes through the CISO mechanism from the right-handed sector, essentially, and not from here. So this is an analogy with the quark sector which we employ, and this is very well motivated, for example, in SO10 GATs. However, I just want to stress that this is not necessarily true, because there are different classes of models in which the mixing in the low energy neutrino sector comes entirely or almost entirely from the left-handed sector and not from the right-handed sector. And these are models based, for example, on SU5. So what we are considering is just one of the two big classes of the CISO models. And we cannot say anything about the different class. So this I wanted to make clear. Okay, Jean-Marie, you want to guess?
It may just mean that there are a few branches, but I don't understand what it means to say that UL, for example, would be close to identity. Probably you don't mean close to identity. Because it depends on how you label your parts, which is V right, which tells you. Yeah. Imagine I have a matrix which is indeed identity.
Yeah.
And I rename my quark, right-handed quark number one, I call it number two. Then I get 0, 1, 1, 1.
Yes.
Which is far from identity.
Sure. So we assume that in this basis, in which this is close to identity, the eigenvalues of the Dirac mathematics, and we call it MU, MC, and MTOP, having in mind some analogy with the up-type quark matrices, but they need not exactly coincide with the masses of U-type and C-type and P-type quarks. We assume that exactly in this basis we have the inequality like this. This is our assumption.
Oh, yeah, hold it by.
Yeah, this is our assumption. Okay. Now, if we plug in this formula for M Dirac into the CISO formula, this one, so we can find the following. First, this right-handed rotation, we can absorb into the redefinition of M right here. This is nothing but the choice of the basis. So we choose the basis of right-handed neutrinos in such a way that this is the basis in which the Dirac mathematics has been diagonalized, the right-handed rotation has been done. So this is merely the choice of the basis. Okay. Now, this is important, as I said, but we assume it to be either unity or close to unity. How much close to unity? We allow it to differ from unity by about the Kabibo rotation. So we follow the analogy with the quark sector and say that this is either unity or can deviate from unity by about as much as the Kabibo CKM mixing matrix of quark can deviate from unity. And it turns out that allowing this matrix to deviate from unity in this range is essentially equivalent to allowing the variation of the leptonic mixing parameter in their allowed ranges. So the allowed ranges are more or less of the same size. So by using this, by exploring this variation of the leptonic mixing parameter in this range, we more or less cover possible deviation of this matrix from unity in our approach. So in the end, we find this formula and we want to substitute unity here or nearly unity here. So we can find directly the inverse mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos from this expression. Here there's effective mass matrix of light neutrinos, but again, if this is close to unity, it just coincides with the mass matrix, the usual one, without prime. So now we have everything we need, and we can proceed to find out the information about the right-handed neutrino sector. So as I said, we first have to find this mass matrix, which we do in the usual way. And we obtain some matrix with elements MEE, ME mu, ME tau, and so on. And let me just mention that this one, MEE, is important for the neutrinoless double beta decay. Now, there are very simple expressions for the elements of this matrix in terms of the low energy neutrino parameters. For example, if we take into account that U is 3 is small, the theta 1, 3 is small, then for MEE we get this simple expression. And here I forgot to say, we assume that these masses are complex because we don't know CP violating phases. We included them into the low energy neutrino masses. So these are now complex parameters. We allow them to be complex, all these light neutrino masses. Now, if we multiply the light neutrino mass matrix on the left and on the right by the inverse mass matrix of Dirac neutrinos, which is diagonal in our basis, we get a very interesting, a very characteristic structure of the inverse mass matrix of heavy right-handed neutrinos. The element MEE is divided by mu squared. The element ME mu is divided by mu mc. The element ME tau is divided by mu m tau. Mu mu is divided by mc squared, and so on. So we get a very characteristic and interesting structure of the right-handed inverse mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos. Now, this gives a very strong enhancement of this element. We have a small enhancement of the second element, even a little bit smaller here. But of course, we have to know what is in the numerator. The denominator shows us the enhancement. We have to know what in the numerator is. And here comes a very important point. And this important point is the consequence of the latest data, latest Kamlan data. The important point is that we know that the solution of the solar neutrino problem is now LMA. It's not one of the four possible solutions, as it used to be SMA, LMA, law, and vacuum oscillation. We know that it is LMA solution. So this actually tells us, as we shall see, that in the effective mass matrix of light neutrinos, all entries are roughly of the same order of magnitude. There is no big hierarchies there in the mass matrix of light neutrinos. So let me just remind you that people used to discuss a lot some possible textures of light neutrino masses. And this is zero approximation structure of possible structure of neutrino mass matrix, assuming that, for example, delta M squared solar is much smaller than delta M squared atmospheric. So these are structures which contain a number of zeros. For example, for the normal hierarchy, we have only one such texture. For invert hierarchy, there are three textures with plus and minus sign here, and also a different one. And there are a number of textures for quasi-degenerate light neutrinos. Now, the important point is that this is a very simple first approximation, and of course we have to fill in these zeros with some small elements to get some realistic mass structure. In order, for example, to obtain non-zero delta M squared solar, we have to put something in. And it turns out that in the case of the LMA solution, because the ratio of the solar and atmospheric mass square differences is just about a factor of 30, it's not too small, these entries here are about just 1/5 or 1/6 of these entries. So there is no big hierarchy. And the same here, and even more so in the case of the quasi-degenerate neutrinos. So to a rough first approximation, all the entries of the light neutrino mass matrix are roughly of the same order of magnitude, generically. Of course, there may be some special cases in which there are constellations. For example, the element MEE may, by some accidental reason, be nearly zero because of the constellation of different contributions to it. Yes, it is possible, and we consider such situations too, but let me first start with a generic case in which we assume there are no such special constellations. Then we have all elements here roughly of the same order of magnitude. Now, what does it mean? It means that when we calculate the inverse mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos, it gets a very hierarchical structure. So let me introduce some parameter lambda, which is roughly of the order of mu over mc or mc over m top. It doesn't matter for me whether, I mean, it's just these two ratios are exactly equal to each other or of the same order of magnitude. Just for simplicity, let me assume. In reality, if you just take the quark masses, they are. But for me, it's not so important. Now, this would mean that m to the minus 1, if we take out the coefficient of the first term here, has this structure, 1, lambda, lambda square, lambda square, lambda cube, lambda 4. And this is a very hierarchical structure. And this structure allows us to immediately obtain the masses and the mixing parameters of right-handed neutrinos. The biggest eigenvalue of this m to the minus 1, which corresponds to the lightest of the heavy neutrino masses, is just this element times this, of course. So we immediately obtain m1 to the minus 1 given by this expression. Now, the second one is obtained from this dominant block here. This block is dominant, obviously. So from this block, from its determinant, we immediately obtain the second eigenvalue, which is this element minus this square divided by this one. It resembles the CISO formula, but this time for the right-handed neutrinos. Now, how about the third mass eigenvalue? The third mass eigenvalue can be obtained from the determinant condition for the complete neutrino mass matrix. So if we take just the CISO formula, the usual CISO formula, and take the determinant of both sides, we obtain this expression, relation between the masses of light neutrinos, Dirac-type masses, and the mass of heavy neutrinos. So if we know already M1 and M2, we can find M3 immediately. So it's very simple. Now, we also need, in addition to this, we also need the mixing parameters. And the mixing parameters are important not only by themselves, we want to know how the right-handed neutrinos are mixed, but in addition for the leptogenesis, because typically the formulas for leptogenesis are obtained in the basis where the heavy neutrino mass matrix is diagonal. And we work in the basis where the Dirac mass matrix is diagonal. And the relation between them is the following. This is the important parameter which we need, which enters into all the expressions for the leptogenesis. So if we rewrite it in our basis, where this is diagonal, we see that it should be multiplied on the left and on the right by this mixing matrix of right-handed neutrinos. So it directly enters into the leptogenesis expressions. And from the hierarchical structure of the right-handed neutrino mass matrix, it's very easy to find the mixing parameter of right-handed neutrinos. So to simplify the notation, I will be using notation m twiddle for m1 to the minus 1, because I'll need it many times not to carry this superscript always. So you immediately find that the mixing parameters are the diagonal ones are approximately 1. The over-diagonal 2-1 is approximately m1 twiddle over m1-1, m1-2 twiddle over m1-1, and so on. So very simple way to find all the mixing parameters. And this is in terms of the right-handed neutrino mass matrix, but we also want to know them in terms of the low energy observables. And then we can just express these elements of m twiddle through the elements of the light neutrino mass, we obtain these expressions. And the important point is that all the off-diagonal elements are small. These are of order lambda, these are of order lambda square, and this is also of order lambda. So in this case, we find a very interesting situation. Mixing both in the left-handed sector and the right-handed sector is very small. And yet we get a strong mixing for low energy for light neutrinos, which may look very strange and puzzling. It looks like we get strong mixing in the electronic sector out of nothing. So I already said that we assume that the mixing in the left-handed sector is small. Now we obtain that in this generic case, the mixing in the right-handed sector is also small. And still we get a very strong mixing in the sector of light neutrinos. And the explanation is very simple, actually. What's going on is the following. The smallness of the mixing in both cases, in the right-handed sector and the left-handed sector, is related to the fact that these two sectors are very hierarchical. The masses are very hierarchical. On the other hand, in the Cissot formulas, these hierarchies act in the opposite way. So when you take the product of the three matrices, you end up with a matrix which is not hierarchical, which has all the entries of the same order of magnitude, and therefore the mixing is large. So these hierarchies work in the opposite direction. And this was noticed by many people, Smirnov in 93, and then studied by a number of other people, that Cissot can actually enhance leptonic mixing.
In a way, that also means that the off-diagonal elements
yes.
are suppressing kind of geometrical means when you go down. So your matrix becomes more degenerate, but the mixing stays there.
Sorry, I didn't quite.
Well, yeah. The diagonal elements, the one element would go like 1 over m1 squared.
Yes.
The other one element would go like 1 over m1
yeah.
m2 squared.
Yeah.
The off diagonal element would probably go like 1 over m1 and 2.
Yes.
And as a result, the off diagonal elements become practically preponderant.
Yes. Now, to summarize these results for this generic case, if we assume, take into account that S13 is small, we can have some simplified formulas for the masses of heavy right-handed neutrinos. And these are given here. This is just mu squared divided by essentially square root of the solar mass squared difference. This is square root of the atmospheric mass squared difference. And this is unknown M1, about which we only know that it should be smaller than M2, and therefore there is only the lower limit on the mass of the third of heavy neutrinos. So we get very hierarchical structure of the heavy Majorana sector with typical masses of around 10 to 7 GeV, 10 to 11 GeV, and 10 to 15 GeV. Now, it is interesting to compare this with a different way of writing the Cissot formulas. The standard way is not to express the heavy neutrino masses through the light neutrino masses, but the other way around. People usually express the masses of light left-handed neutrinos in terms of the masses of heavy neutrinos. So if we do this, we find something very unusual and unexpected. Typically, people would expect that the mass of the lightest neutrino goes like mu square, the second one goes as mc square, and the third one, sorry, should be small, goes as m top square. But what we get is quite different. The lightest one goes as m top square divided by m3. The second one goes as mu square divided by m1. And the third one goes like mc square divided by m2. So there's a complete swap between them. And this is the consequence of the LMA solution of the solar neutrino problem. Because, for example, if we assume the SMA solution, what happens here is the following. Here, in fact, we have not M2, as it is simplified case, but the element MEE. If you remember, this is the one which is responsible for the double beta decay. If we assume small mixing angle, then instead of M2, we'll have M1 here, times cosine square of theta 1, 2. And therefore, for M1, we would get proportionality to mu square. So the fact that this is kind of very swapped situation is a consequence of the LMA solution of the solar neutrino problem. Now, how about leptogenesis? There's a very simple formula in this case, neglecting S13 for this effective mass parameter M1 twiddle. It's just given by this ratio. Using this right-handed mixing, which I already showed you before, very easy to derive this formula. And we can see that if we assume that M1 is indeed much smaller than M2, from this formula, we just directly get that M1 twiddle is given to M2. It's the effective mass parameter which enters into the leptogenesis analysis is just equal to the solar mass, M2. Now, if we consider this was the normal hierarchy, I will not bother you with all details of the inverted hierarchy and quasi-degenerate case. Let me just say that the conclusion that we have a very strong hierarchy between the masses of the right-handed neutrinos remains true and becomes even more true because we have a stronger hierarchy here. Just because M1 is no longer square root, no longer a small mass, but it's square root of the atmospheric mass square difference in the case of the inverted hierarchy. So we have a very hierarchical spectrum of the right-handed neutrinos, and the same is also true for the quasi-degenerate neutrinos.
Can you remind me what you were assuming when you found the lower bound on M1 of like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10, which is not true here because you're getting much lighter?
Yeah. You just need to produce epsilon 1. So epsilon 1 is the CP asymmetry produced in the decay of the lightest of heavy neutrinos. And it's directly proportional to M1. If M1 is too small, you just don't produce enough asymmetry.
So you're not...
Even if you assume zero washout, there's a washout on top of that.
Yeah.
But even if you assume no washout at all, you just don't produce enough.
So for this M1, you would not
produce? You would not produce. So the conclusion is that in this case, there is no leptogenesis. This was the case which we call the generic one. And in this generic case, you just don't produce enough epsilon 1. Epsilon 1 turns out to be small, too small. And this formula, I mean, these expressions here, Y dagger Y, these are just the Yukawa couplings which enter into the Dirac mass matrix, can be easily calculated with the mixing parameters which we obtained, and you just confirm that the result is too small.
Let me understand, too small in the inverted hierarchy or in both normal and inverted?
In all of them,
ah.
In all of them, but assuming what we call the generic case that there are no cancellations between the entries of various entries of the light neutrino mass matrix. So this we call the generic case. Now, we have, of course, to consider the situations in which there may be some cancellations. And in that case, the result will be different. So before I go to these special cases for which I have 10 or 15 minutes, let me just say that how one could save in principle this case for the generic case. So this is actually the formula which for the epsilon 1, the asymmetry epsilon 1 in this generic case, which we obtained using this all the results which I described before. You can express it in terms of the mass of the lightest Dirac eigenvalue. And it's given by this expression here, you see. And in order to get epsilon 1 bigger than 10 to minus 6, which you generally need to get the viable Baryonic symmetry, you need to assume that the parameter mu, which is the lightest of the Dirac entries, is bigger than 350 MeV. So it goes contrary to all our expectations about the seesaw mechanism and the possible structure of the Dirac mass matrix.
So when you are using the upper part values for
emulating them in the neutrino sectors.
Yeah.
Do you do the mass evolution?
We assume them at the leptogenesis scale, about 10 to the 10.
And that's
it's just a factor. It makes things worse.
It makes things worse
because the quark masses run increase towards the lower scale. If you go to the upper scale, they become smaller.
So this, then your neutrino masses will not evolve.
Yes. So this makes things worse. But I mean, we don't talk about factors of two or three. This is factor of three typically.
Like
yeah. But we don't talk about factors. These are orders of magnitude. So. It doesn't save on.
Factor of three because it's MB over N tau.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you have to be more careful here because it's factor of three for quarks, but we don't really use quarks. We assume that they're similar to quarks, but at the high scale.
No, but that's what I tell you.
Yeah.
If you take SU five, MB over N tau is one.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the high scale.
Yeah.
So that means that you have to take a factor of three off the quark.
Or more or less a factor of three. Yeah.
Yeah. This doesn't tell us anything about the CP phase.
It does tell us about the CP phase. So CP phase, if you remember when I showed you the expression for U-right, the mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos, it contained some ratios of the mass parameters which were complex. So this contains CP phase already. These are the CP phase which are coming from the light neutrino sector. There are two sources of CP phases in the heavy Majorana sector in this approach. One is just the CP phases which are contained in the mass matrix of light neutrinos. And this we take into account. Another one is the CP phases which are contained in possible left-handed rotation, which we neglect. We assume that left-handed mass matrix is unity. But in general, there are CP phases which is a separate source of CP phases. And we have no handle on this. So we just consider one source. But this is, so in principle, if there's another source, there may be some additional phases here, but this would not make this coefficient bigger. The coefficient will stay the same. It comes from the absolute values of the masses. So it will not save us.
Yeah, I mean, you always assume that this...
So we always assume that this is maximized. So the imaginary part of the phases can be... But one should be careful. In this generic case, it's always one can always do that. In some special cases in which we considered, like quasi-Dirac neutrino in the right-handed sector, there may be some cancellation in the phases too, and we have to study, and we actually study that. Okay, so since I have not much time, let me accelerate a little bit. So what are the special cases? The special cases are the following. You remember when I found the second mass of the heavy Majorana neutrino masses, second of the heavy Majorana neutrino masses, I was assuming that the leading contribution comes from the dominant block 1-2 in the inverse mass matrix of neutrinos, and I found this second mass from the determinant condition of this block. But it may be that for some accidental reason, this determinant is zero. So then you cannot do that. You cannot find this mass matrix from this this second mass from this dominant block, even though it is dominant. But you remember the entries 1 and 2-2, product of these two, and the square of 1-2 were of the same order. So in general, there may be cancellation. Second special case is when the element MEE is very small, so that MEE divided by MU square is much smaller than MEMU divided by MUMC. So it's nearly zero. And then, of course, this analysis also doesn't work, the analysis which I described before. The third special case is if both MEE is zero and MEMU is zero. This is equivalent to having the combination of these two cases, because when MEE is zero and MEMU is zero, it's also the subdeterminant of this dominant block is also zero. So it's a combination of them. So we have to study all of them. And the first case with subdeterminant is zero, but the element MEE is not zero. The condition for this is given here, in terms of the light neutrino masses and mixing parameters. And for M1, we get the same expression as before. But for M2, we have to work not with the inverted mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos, but with the mass matrix itself. And it has also a very hierarchical structure. But here, the biggest element is 3-3. So the structure is like a mirror image, in a sense, of this structure of the inverted mass matrix. And if the subdeterminant in 1-2 sector of the M to the minus 1 is 0, this means that this element is, in fact, instead of being 1, becomes 0 or nearly 0. And for some reason, it turns out that this element, which is in general small, lambda squared, has additional some numerical smallness. So the masses of the eigenvalues 2 and 3 of this matrix are essentially given by these two elements. So it's like a quasi-Dirac neutrino. And we get M2 and M3 are plus and minus essentially MC M top divided by square root of delta M square atmospheric. So we have one relatively light heavy neutrino and two heavier quasi-degenerate heavy neutrinos in this case. The important point is that M1 is still too small to be relevant for the leptogenesis. So this case doesn't work either. So it's easy to find out the mixing parameters. I will not bother you, well, just maybe 1 minute, just to show that here, the mixing parameters U11 is essentially 1, but U22, 3, 3, and 2, 3 are about 1 over square root by absolute value because of this maximal mixing in the 2, 3 sector of heavy Majorana neutrinos. And if we calculate the asymmetry, the lepton asymmetry in this case, we find out that it is too small as expected. Now, the second case turns out to be the most interesting one. This is the case when MEE is essentially 0. In this case, the inverse mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos, instead of having the biggest element here, has essentially 0 or very small element here. And again, in this dominant block, the main contribution to the masses come from these two elements. So we have a quasi-degenerate situation for two lighter of these heavy neutrinos. And then a heavier third neutrino. The masses of the two lightest neutrinos, of heavy neutrinos, are given by this expression, essentially mu mc divided by square root of delta m square solar. And this is already close to what is interesting from the point of view of leptogenesis. It may look still a little bit too small, but I would like to remind you that here we have a degenerate situation, and in the case of degenerate situation, there may be a very strong enhancement of the lepton asymmetry, and this is exactly what we can have in this case. Now, another interesting point, I just want to attract your attention of those of you who are familiar with the Emsdouble effect. Well, if you look at this combination parameter here, what we have in the denominator is very similar to the MSW Adiabatici parameter. Because the MSW, if you, just to remind you, the MSW Adiabatici parameter is delta M square solar divided by 2e times sine square of 2 theta 1 2 divided by cosine of 2 theta 1 2 times the scale height. And if you look here, this is just the square root of this parameter in the denominator. This is square root of delta m square solar, this is square root of cosine 2 theta 1 2, and this is sine of 2 theta 1 2. It's a funny coincidence, very curious, that this expression almost exactly contains the MSW resonance parameter, Adiabatici parameter. Now, M3 is given by this expression. And one can easily find the mixing parameters in this case. Here we have almost maximal mixing in 1-2 sector. And this is so-called the quasi-Dirac situation for neutrinos. So we used to say that if there are two Majorana neutrinos with opposite CP phases and maximal mixings and they are quasi-degenerate, they form a Dirac or quasi-Dirac state. And therefore, one would expect that probably there should be no leptogenesis at all in this case, because Dirac neutrino conserves lepton number, and we want a lepton number violation. But this turns out to be not true. I don't have to explain it right now. If you ask me questions in the end of my talk, I can explain why it happens. It's a very interesting point. Here it doesn't happen. So there is a leptogenesis, and by tuning the parameters in such a way that we have a very high degree of degeneracy, we in principle can have a viable leptogenesis, viable baryogenesis through leptogenesis in this case. And this is the only case out of those which we studied in which this happens. So the asymmetry epsilon 1 is given by this expression, and this is the contribution of this quasi-degenerate state. The parameter delta here is, this is the enhancement factor, N1 over delta. And the parameter delta is the maximum of the splitting between M1 and M2 and the width of either of these. And it turns out that the width is relatively small. It's around 10 to the 6, minus 6 of the mass of this neutrino, and therefore a significant enhancement is allowed. And the enhancement one needs here is about 10 to the 4, which is perfectly allowed. So this is the only case in which we can have a viable leptogenesis. Now the special case 3, I will discuss very briefly. In this case, you assume that both ME is 0 and ME mu is 0. And you can achieve this if you assume that the mixing angle theta 1,3 is not too small, if it is about 0.1. which is about a factor of 2 smaller than the Shor limit. Then you can tune both these parameters to be nearly zero. And in this situation, what you find, not surprisingly, that all three neutrinos, heavy neutrinos, are nearly degenerate. However, if you calculate the parameter M1 twiddle in this case, it turns out to be huge for two of them and large for the third one. And therefore, there is no successful leptogenesis in this case. Okay, so what happens if we relax the requirement that left-handed rotation is small, that left-handed mass metric is nearly 1? We didn't do the complete study of this case because I think it's either very difficult or impossible, but what we tried to do to find a counterexample to our statement that in the generic case, when you have a strong hierarchy of the masses, you get, when you don't fine-tune the any low-energy neutrino data, you get, you don't get any viable leptogenesis. And we actually found one such case. So I just show you the structure of the inverse mass matrix of right-handed neutrinos. If you take it of this kind, some elements of order A here, and some element epsilon here, then the effective mass matrix of light neutrinos after we multiply by M Dirac from the left and from the right takes this form, and you can find these parameters A and epsilon by requiring that the mass square differences of light neutrinos are what they should be. M2 is square root of the solar mass square difference, and this is square root of the atmospheric mass square difference. So you find this parameter, and everything seems to be fine. And this is exactly the case which corresponds to strong left-handed rotation, because even though this is there is a big mixing here, if you look at the effective mass matrix of light neutrinos because of these suppression factors here, you see that it's almost diagonal. These terms are very small compared to this term. And this exactly means that the left-handed rotation produces the complete mixing at low energy. So the full mixing, large mixing of light neutrinos comes from the left-handed rotation in this case. So this is just the situation opposite to what we considered. So this is just a counterexample. So we cannot claim that our results are valid in the case of arbitrary left-handed rotation. Now conclusions. We attempted a systematic study of the seesaw mechanism within some framework in which we assumed that the Dirac mass matrices of neutrinos are very hierarchical and the left-handed rotation is either absent or very small. And we used as an input the low-energy neutrino data. So generically, if we don't assume any fine-tuning between the parameters of the low energy sector, we obtain an extremely hierarchical structure of the right-handed Majorana neutrino sector with typical masses in this range. And M1 is always too small to produce a necessary baryon asymmetry of the universe. In addition to the genetic case, there are three special cases. One, in one of them, we obtained still two small M1, and M2 and M3 are in this order of magnitude and quasi-degenerate. In the second one, we obtained M1 and M2 around 10 to the 9 GeV, and M3 10 to the 14 GeV, and one can easily tune the parameter in such a way that these two are nearly degenerate, and then we obtain a viable Berenice symmetry of the universe. And there's a third case in which all three neutrinos are about the same mass, about 10 to the 11 GeV. But however, in this case, there are very strong washout effects which kill all the produced asymmetry, even though the masses are rather big. There's a case, or one case, which we found in which the large left-handed rotation is allowed, in which one produces a sufficient Berenice symmetry of the universe without having any tuning of the parameter in the light neutrino sector. And before I finish, I just wanted to add one remark. It may look that all these special cases which we considered are extremely fine-tuned. We have to assume that some parameters in the light neutrino sector cancel each other in a very precise way. However, this looks fine-tuned if we look at it from the low energy side. If you look at the same scenario from the high energy side, from the side of the heavy Majorana neutrinos, it just looks that we need two or three heavy neutrinos to be nearly degenerate, and this is nothing special indeed. There may be some family symmetry in the right-handed sector, there may be some reason for that. So this may not look so contrived if we look at this from the fundamental physics point of view. Okay, thank you.
Further questions, comments?
The slower bound on the right-hand neutrino was basically based on the knowledge of the low-energy neutrinos, which supposedly we have.
Sure.
Now, it seems to me there is a one loophole here, which is you are assuming that the type 1 seesaw is the dominant.
Yes.
Assume you have a combination of two.
It's not a loophole, it's just our framework. We assumed type 1. Of course, if you assume type 2, let me explain to maybe not everyone knows what is type 1, type 2. Is it seen if I write here? Okay, so type 1 is just what I consider. It's called type 1. Type 2 is if you assume that in addition to right-handed neutrinos, you also introduce left-handed Higgs triplet, which may be very natural, for example, in the framework of left-right symmetric models or SO10 GATs. So you need a triplet to produce the mass of right-handed neutrinos, right-handed triplet Higgs. So in the same representation, you can have a left-handed triplet Higgs. And therefore, the mass of effective mass matrix of light neutrinos will have an additional term, which is F left times the VEF of this left-handed triplet Higgs minus M Dirac 1 over MR M Dirac transpose. So there's an additional term. So what we were doing was assuming the type 1 seesaw, or assuming that essentially this term, even if it is there, it is negligible compared to this term. Of course, one can assume, and there are some models in which this term is equally important, or maybe even more important than this term, and then this will be a completely different story.
In the type 2 case that maybe gives successful leptogenesis, what's the consequence for neutrinos double beta decay?
You see, the point is that there is no chance for neutrinos double beta decay. But I don't know if it is of any practical importance or not, because this is in the case of normal hierarchy, in which it's extremely difficult to see neutrinos double beta decay anyway. So this parameter MEE, in this case, is of the order of 10 to minus 3 electron volt or smaller, without cancellation. In the case if there is cancellation, it should be much, much smaller than this. But even with this one, It's already extremely difficult, if not impossible, to observe it experimentally. So it is not clear whether it is of any practical consequence or not. We require this MEE to be additionally suppressed compared to the typical value in the case of normal hierarchy.
So if neutrinoless double beta decay is seen.
Yes, then this closes this window completely.
What happens to the heavier right-handed neutrinos, which are normally stated to play no role in leptogenesis? Why is that? They decay to the lightest one?
No, that's the different thing. Each of them, when it decays, produces some asymmetry. But then when the heavy neutrino produces asymmetry, the lightest one, which is very abundant at that point, washes it out. Because the decay and inverse decay of lightest neutrinos is very efficient. Now, when the lightest decays, the heavy is no longer there. So there is nothing to wash out the asymmetry. So this is what happens.
You're depending on the fact that the universe is cooling.
Yes, exactly.
So it's the two-body reactions from the lightest ones that are washing out the asymmetry?
They're 1 to 2 and 2 to 1 still present. And how much they kill the asymmetry is exactly determined by this factor M1 twiddle divided by M star. And therefore, we want this not to be too big. Otherwise, it will kill the asymmetry. But still, it turns out that even if it is of order 10 to 3, for example, still it's okay, because the final number which we want to explain is extremely small. It's 10 to minus 10. So even if there is a strong washout, still one can have a viable baryogenesis, because the final number is very small, the number which we want to achieve. So maybe I'll add a little comment which I already mentioned. It looks curious to me why, in the case of the quasi-Dirac neutrinos, we can still have baryogenesis.
When you meant quasi-Dirac, it's quasi-Dirac in 1-2 space, in U space, in a way.
Well, let's consider two neutrino situation.
Yeah, assume. It's a right-handed neutrino 1-1 and 1-2.
Yes.
And it's in that space.
Yes.
Yeah. So it has nothing to do with the.
Still, the question is, if you can introduce a conserved lepton number, then leptogenesis should be impossible. You see, it doesn't matter whether it is right-handed or left-handed. It doesn't matter. So, but there's a different thing here. Let me just very quickly explain what's going on. You know that in the case of, for example, double beta decay, in quasi-Dirac neutrino contributes very little, and in the limit when it becomes a Dirac, it doesn't contribute at all. So the mathematics assumed to have two neutrino species. And the mathematics is like this. There are two big elements equal to each other and two small elements here. And in the limiting case, there are just zeros here and two equal elements here. And this is known to describe a Dirac neutrino, which contribute nothing to double beta decay. And the reason is the following. If we write down the charge lepton interaction, charge current interaction here, and the mass term, we can rewrite the mass term for these two neutrinos in the following way, taking into account that this can be written as the charge conjugate of left-handed state, and this is CP conjugate actually of left-handed state, you can introduce some Dirac state in which whose left-handed component is nu LA and right-handed component is a conjugate of nu LB. So the mass term can be written as Dirac mass term. Now, the important point is not whether or not it is possible to do that, but the question whether you can assign in a consistent way the lepton number to these neutrinos. Here you can do that, because if you say that the field nu LA has lepton number plus 1, nu LB lepton number minus 1, so these terms conserve lepton number. And this term, of course, also conserves lepton number. And of course, the charge current interaction conserves the lepton number as well if we assign the correct lepton number to the charge lepton. Now, what happens? This was for the usual neutrinos and for double beta decay. Now, why the situation is different in the case of the baryogenesis through leptogenesis? The reason is the following. You, in principle, cannot assign in a consistent way the lepton number if the Yukawa couplings are there. Here, the only charge current interaction is there. If you introduce the Yukawa coupling, then immediately you see that they break this lepton number assignment unless either diagonal terms or off-diagonal terms are absent. If there are only diagonal terms or only off-diagonal terms, you can also assign the lepton number in a consistent way and you will have a conserved lepton number. But if both are present, you cannot. And both have to be present in order to have CP violation. If only diagonal or off-diagonal terms are there, you can rotate CP violation away. Therefore, even though it looks like a quasi-Dirac situation, it is actually not in the right-handed sector. Okay.
Nothing else?
One shot.
Let's take it at the ending again.